Hi everyone, I'm Lula.
And I'm Jude.
And welcome back to Just Friends.
Yes.
Woo! Today we have a very, very, very special podcast guest that Jude is going to introduce.
This week, I have the honor of introducing the last guest of season one. Rufus Grizzgom is the co-founder of Nerve, an online magazine about sex and relationships, the co-founder of Babbel, an online magazine of blog network for parents, and is currently the host of the Next Big Idea podcast. Although I only first had the chance to talk to Rufus this summer, it felt like reconnecting with an old friend. His warmth, silliness, and wit truly surprised me. So, Rufus, thank you so much for joining us on the pod. Welcome.
Guys, I am honored to be here. Thank you for
Woo.
having me. It's wonderful to be on the other side of a podcast. Fantastic.
Have you ever been the guest of a podcast?
Just a couple times.
Okay.
Whereas I've been the host a couple hundred times, so I've spent more time. But I think it's great to be the guest.
Yeah. Do you feel like being the guest has changed the way that you like interview people?
Oh, interesting. I don't know that I've spent enough time as a guest. I'll tell you at the end of this show whether I change it. But certainly, I would certainly say that like my approach to podcasting has evolved over the 3 or 4 years, and it's a journey that I'm still on. That there's no question that it's an evolving, thing, and it's a and it's an art, and there's so many different approaches to it,
I know we are going to go back in history and like hear a little bit more about your story, but I just have to like grab one thing because I'm curious. You said art. Do you think podcasting is an art form?
Well, I would say that conversation between Homo sapiens is one of the greatest art forms, right? And podcasts are effectively recorded conversations for the purpose of, sharing with a larger audience. So it's really taking human conversations and putting them on a pedestal. I mean, what's so funny about them is that the technology's archaic, right? I mean, it's kind of funny that podcasting is still new-ish. And then it's kind of emerged as a cultural phenomenon in the last decade, when really it's like, radio technology. I mean, it's like recording audio is just ancient, but it's such a kind of, in my opinion, kind of like beautiful countervailing force to the just frenetic, ever shorter video culture, right, that we have on the other side of the balance, right? I mean, it's a space in which we can be, kind of patient and thoughtful, which is not, the YouTube experience.
Some of my favorite podcasts are like 3 hours long, and people are like, when I tell them I listen to them, they're like, "What, dude? Like, what?" And I'm like, "Well, I'd rather do that and listen to a real conversation than watch 3 hours of YouTube or like a 2 hour movie. Like, it's conversation. Yeah, like it's satisfying. We don't get that enough."
And you have permission to do the dishes, or like file your nails or drive your car, right? And this makes possible the patience to really let other human beings represented by their voices and ideas sink in at a different kind of pace, I think.
I like that.
I love it. I think we're going to take that with us forever because Jude and I are always in a debate of is the podcast art? And I think, I don't know, I think focusing on the conversation aspect is really helpful because I think a lot of times when you and I talk about it, Jude, it's more about like the production side of it. We're like, is everything we're putting into this, does that keep it art or does it change it into something else? But I think at its core, it's very much like, oh, we just met you 3 seconds ago. Press record. What's gonna happen? And I think that's
Yeah,
awesome.
that's kind of one of my favorite things about bringing on guests is that like it is just like so spontaneous. Like I think that's like part of the thing I love about conversations and like connection is that it's like spontaneous, authentic connection. And like Lula, it's definitely like authentic connection, but like I kind of know what we talk about, And so bringing in another guest also is kind of like exciting because it's like I have no idea. Like there are so many places this conversation should and can go, and it's just like
Overwhelm it.
Totally. Yeah. The serendipity, the elements of surprise. It's like, which is, I think, is inherent in one of our favorite topics that Jude and I talked about in our first conversation, which is fun, is like the human experience of fun. And I think surprise is a really important piece of that, which is why conversations have the potential to be a lot of fun.
Fun is like such a interesting word for like, also I'm just like playing with like your career path, which I think we should talk about, but like the nerve, the parenting, like there's a lot of play and fun within all of this. And I'm curious, like, do you think that you could have like identified your like your appreciation for like fun and play early on? Or like, is that in more recent years you've been able to like kind of identify, oh, I really care about play and fun? I use those words because they're not, I don't think, I do not think they're synonymous.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
They're different.
No, I think I've had a bias towards fun and joy and kind of framing human experience in a kind of positive framing opposed to negative framing. I mean, you know, there, like we all are experience a lot of pain, and we all, you know, you know, endure a lot of hardship and experience that we don't want to have, but that's often the flip side of joy. And so I think I've had a little bit of a kind of chasing the butterflies, you know, impulse from a relatively young age. And that's carried through my journey. And it's just miraculous that I've been able to actually, you know, earn a living and, you know, put kids through school and all that stuff along the way.
Would you just tell Lula the story about your hat? Because this is like, this is the first thing that my dad told me about you. And I just love it. I think it like is such a rich.
Oh, which, is this
the hat,
rubber ducky hat
with that you,
well,
yes,
I happen to have a visual aid here. It's funny. Cause I actually did not remember that we talked about that, but yeah, here is the rubber ducky hat, which it's,
oh my gosh,
you could think of it as a very, again, another simple form of technology. So what we're looking at, for those who can't see the video here, is a $12 straw hat that has had a series of little rubber duckies affixed to it with a hot glue gun. And I kind of wear it around and count how many people come up to me and ask me about it. Or asked to take a photo or whatever. I've always had a fondness for talking with strangers, you know, who of course, you know, become non-strangers very quickly as soon as you start talking to them. It's a temporary status. The stranger status is a temporary status. And so I think I sort of feel like funny hats and clothing. I mean, they're when you see someone wearing funny hats and clothing, there are two possible explanations. One is this person didn't get enough attention as a child. And right. And a second possible one is they are making fun of themselves visually, not taking themselves too seriously in order to give other people permission to not take themselves too seriously. And in order to sort of open up the possibility of conversation and, you know, the, you know, between strangers. And, of course, I prefer the second explanation, because I think I did get a fair amount of attention as a child. But yeah, no, it's effectively, it's a walking, the rubber ducky hat is a walking conversation piece.
I love it. I had no, there's our spontaneity right off the bat. I had no idea this was, did not expect a fashion show and tell as soon as we started. But I really love the like unseriousness aspect of what you just said. I think Jude, I forget what episode it was. It might have been Eugene, but we had a guest join the Zoom and you and I were hysterically laughing about something and like completely not focused and forgot we were on a Zoom. And our guest was like, oh, I love that you guys are having a good time because it makes it so much less intimidating for me to join in. And I think now we've like kind of intentionally been not preparing when what the guest is about to join in. We kind of set up, I mean, when you walked in, we were talking about my wisdom tooth ailments and I don't even know what else. And I think there's something about like not taking yourselves too seriously that is definitely inviting, even in a weird little Zoom form.
I'm curious because like I think that is just part of who you are, Rufus. And like as an entrepreneur who like kind of had to take themselves relatively seriously, at least like when you were like conducting business, how did you balance those, the like the desire to play and be silly and not take yourself too seriously with this like kind of culture that's like take yourself seriously and grind, grind, grind?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting question. I mean, Well, and so, you know, so the lack of seriousness was reflected in my first real business I started was nerve.com, which launched in June of 1997. And it was the tagline, our original tagline was literate smut. And it aspired to be a kind of smart and playful online magazine about sex and culture for women and men. And we really, it was very important to us that we had sort of like a 50-50 or 60-40 ratio of like female to male, you know, readers. And of course, literate smut itself was meant to be funny, that like suggesting that most smut was not literate. And so we weren't saying, oh, this is genius or this is art. We were just saying it's literate. But we got all these wonderful, many of my favorite writers to write these incredible personal essays and short stories. And we had, you know, photographs of naked people. I totally scandalized my family, my mother in particular. She's still recovering. But I would wear kind of a serious kind of, you know, collared shirt, like a press collared shirt Monday to Friday, when taking meetings with investors and advertisers, and, you know, I tended to have a uniform Monday to Friday in terms of actually my dress. So as to communicate to others and myself some minimum level of seriousness, right? But I kind of have the view that almost everything, like, we know that like people learn better when they're happier, when they're experiencing more joy, like pedagogy of joy, more joy equals more learning. You know, curiosity is clearly like a huge driver for everything good. And I think that's true in business too. Like, I think it's really hard to, you know, I think people want to engage with brands and products that are expressions of joy and love. And it's really hard to do that if you're not feeling any joy or any love. Right. So, clearly what one needs, it takes a shit ton of, you know, perseverance, to really get anything done. Right. So one has to have some degree of seriousness, but I've always preferred the view of like, I recently I've been very into nutrition. I've been interviewing a lot of a big kind of scientists and heavyweight nutrition experts for the podcast. And, you know, you can frame it as like, oh, here are all the foods you shouldn't eat because they'll gradually kill you. Or you can frame it as like, look how beautiful and delicious all these healthy foods are, you know, and let's like celebrate that. Right. So either approach to eating nutritious food is available. And the question is like, you want to stick a fork in your palm and be a masochist? Some people do. I mean, some people like a masochistic, you know, you like denying themselves things or, you know, get satisfaction from that process. I'm fundamentally just not wired that way. I'm not a good masochist. So I try to do the joy framing.
I think, I mean, like you're saying, the joy framing can take a lot of different forms. There's a lot of different manifestations of joy in our pop culture. There's a lot of different kind of advertising. I don't know, caution with that word, but I guess I'm curious, like, why did you choose to focus on quote literate smut in the 90s?
Yeah.
Like, why was the vehicle?
So I graduated from college in 1991 with Jude's father, one of my favorite people on the planet. And
shout out
Andy Sack, ASAC.
And shout out.
You know, and really the first few years out of college, I think, can often be a little bit humbling because it's like, oh shit. The world that was heretofore organized around my edification and delight has now been entirely reorganized around the profit margins of companies that I'm supposed to work for that basically barely notice my presence. So, I mean, that can be like a sobering kind of process, I think, for a lot of people. It was for me. And I thought I wanted to be a book editor And I thought I wanted to go into academia. I thought I wanted to be a writer. And I was a young book editor. And I learned very quickly that my love of dark, tortured fiction and serious literature was a liability. I needed to either develop an appetite for humorous cookbooks or find another profession. And so I was like, okay, it seems like actually the public is not interested in serious literature. So, and I actually do kind of want to make some money, or and I also would like to, I'd like to, you know, do things that have an impact on people at some degree of scale. Right. I mean, I'd like to interact. I'd like to, you know, interact with the gears of the world outside me in a way that has an impact. Right. And so I thought, but I do like serious literature. So maybe if it's serious writing about sex, maybe people will want to read that. Right. So, I mean, I think one of the hard things or one of the challenges maybe or puzzles actually, A.J. Jacobs has this great framing that like every challenge you can reframe as a puzzle. A puzzle is fun. A challenge is a bummer. So we'll call it a puzzle, right? So the puzzle is like, how do I, you know, I mean, unfortunately, like the world does not owe us a lucrative career doing exactly what we want to do. Like, right? but there is this puzzle of figuring out like, where's the intersection between the stuff that really freaking lights me up, that makes me just glow and get covered in goosebumps. I'm getting some goosebumps right now thinking about it. And the stuff that interests everybody else, okay, second circle of the Venn diagram, and a business model that actually works. The third circle, it took me another 10 years to figure that out. So, but when I started nerd.com, it was basically like my interests and everybody else's interests. So I was like, okay, I mean, I like sex too. It wasn't that I didn't like sex. So there was that. It was just very pragmatic. Like, okay, we're going to do, you know, serious writing and art about sex and relationships. But the other piece too, was that I've always had the conversational mad scientist impulse to basically notice when a topic comes up that makes people uncomfortable. And you see the blush zone, you see people shifting in their seats, and you also notice that people are starting to lie. Like people aren't, you know, you begin to suspect that you're not sure that, you know, that people are telling the truth. That's interesting, right? As soon as people are lying and as soon as people are uncomfortable, well, the conversational mad impulse in me always wanted to push on that. Like, okay, what's that? Let's go deeper on that. And so sex was fascinating to me as a topic, because it was because of the humanity and all the discomfort. And this to some degree was a problem for us, because the San Francisco based pro sex kind of sexual liberation community was all about like, taboos are the enemy. We want to get rid of all taboos. And when nobody experiences any taboos or embarrassment, then we will have won. And, you know, and I had more of a, we, I should just say, we had more, our attitude was more like, you know what? We want to gnaw on taboos like squeaky dog toys. We think taboos are what makes it interesting. So we don't want to get rid of them. We want to shine a light on this and explore the humanity in this.
I have so many questions. What was your favorite taboo to explore?
Oh gosh. I mean, you know, we had, I think, a few different writers write about, and this is 25 years ago. So now I, you know, it's a little haze here between that and that, but about kind of women wanting to know what it felt like to be a man in a sexual situation, and men wanting to understand what it felt like to be a woman, and this kind of like, you know, which when you think about the human experience, that's sort of one of those things that's just not quite accessible and very intriguing. We had someone who had written for The New Yorker who was in jail write about sexual abstinence in jail and what that experience was like. We had Joycelyn Elders, who was the Surgeon General, who was fired for talking about masturbation. She wrote a piece, a personal essay for us about masturbation. All that kind of stuff. You know, we were definitely, we had one guy who was like had a kind of fetish around, you know, very large I mean, in terms of scale, like the female is 10 times his size and scale, and he's very small, right? And explored that in a way that was kind of fascinating. So basically, we were pretty broad in pursuing the fringes of kind of human experience there.
Okay, I got to ask what sex advice or relationship advice you have to give to college kids.
Trouble. I mean, everybody knows all the, you know, the kindness, politeness, communication stuff, right? Which is so important. Well, I have teenage boys, right? And so, I gave them all the sort of standard advice you're supposed to give your teenage boys. But the other thing I said is like, look, I personally don't think there's anything wrong with porn. But if you can find the subset of porn that's actually people who are genuinely having fun and actually having orgasms and are actually, you know, like not performing for the camera, but they're actually like engaged in making their bodies feel good, that will actually result in your getting an education in like how the human body operates. Mm. And that's a very small subset of the porn out there, but hunt that down. You can find it. It's there. And because the sort of, you know, that kind of see something, have an orgasm, see something, have an orgasm, that's about as powerful of a kind of learning circuit as we get. And so if you look at the fake stuff, you know, you're imprinting your brain with something that's maybe not what you want to be imprinting your brain with. But you can also, you know, you can find stuff that I think is an expression of human connection and joy.
One of the craziest things that I've heard about pornography is like that you're actually not even training your brain and reinforcing this dopamine system that's already super strong with having sex. You're actually reinforcing your dopamine system of watching other people have sex, which is super interesting. And also, this is the first time in human history where you can see more naked bodies online than like a king in like 200 years ago. Like there are so many naked bodies out there. So what's happening is like you're actually filtering. So this is the same issue that Lou and I have talked about with Tinder and Bumble. You're actually filtering out a lot of people that you may actually think of attractive and actually maybe your type, because you're just like you have like the cream of the crop. You can just choose anything. It's really screwing up a lot of sexual motivation and behavior amongst our younger generation, which is scary. But yeah, but I do think it's a cool way to like consider porn, not in just like a very like it's good or bad. I think porn can do a lot of great things. It can teach people what they're interested in and into. But I really like your rule or your guideline about that. It's a cool way of thinking about it.
Yeah, I do too. I have a question that I don't think I'm going to phrase well, but I think when you were talking more about nerve, I was wondering like if how you feel about like your kids seeing that this is what you've worked on. I don't know if that makes any sense, but just like my parents were like in the music industry. And sometimes I just think about like, oh, stuff they've done. I wonder if they're ever going to tell me what was actually going on in that other world. And I think now, obviously, you're very open with talking about like advice with porn, et cetera, et cetera. And now I'm just thinking more back to the taboo conversation of kind of your instinct to push into the taboo instead of get rid of it. I guess the expected reaction to having a sex talk with your parents is to like squirm away. And I guess I'm wondering if you think that that instinct should still exist or if it should be just like eradicated, like a normal conversation, or should it still be a little on the fringe?
It's a great question. I mean, I my parents were really conservative and square. And so for me, that was the model of like what parents were like, right? And to me, it always felt sort of appropriate that like, oh, I would never tell my parents anything because, they'd faint and get a concussion. You know, that would be if I were to tell them the truth about my life. You know, so that was sort of like, to me growing up, that was just the way it was, and that felt appropriate, you know, just as a kind of norm. But given my background and given, you know, I think it's that's hopefully has not been my kids' experience. I will say that actually, like, definitely for me, it was really uncomfortable to talk with my kids about sex. I think probably uh-huh. Jude's dad did a better job. I actually got some advice from your dad. I mean, he's so good about, like, I think starting early and often. I mean, I think just sort of, I think the idea of like, hey, we're just going to talk about, you know, drugs and sex and all the hot button topics early and often and normalize that. I think that's probably a great thing to do. And I mean, you know, and we all know, I mean, as parents, like, we're totally tuned into the fact that, you know, every kid is like, okay, I'm going to take a subset of what I've seen from my parents and their opinions and maybe those that I agree with and use that as something that I can use in my life. And then I'm going to maybe react in polar opposition to all the things that I found annoying or objectionable or backwards. And so, you know, like as a parent, like you're kind of flipping the coin to some degree. I mean, like you're humble before the unknown in terms of, like, you know, how kids, I really, all you can do is say, hey, here's a way to live a life that I'm, you know, that you see in front of you. And here are a set of opinions about what I've learned in 55 years. And I hope some of them are useful. You know, I mean, I think a huge amount of humility is appropriate, you know.
I'm curious. Oh, do you have a question, Lula? You.
I was going to say that was a perfect segue into Babel. So I think
that's
you...
nice.
Okay. Okay.
Nice
you perfectly
segue.
Segued
Very
us.
Well done.
Okay. So I'm assuming everyone knows what Babel is, but if you want to give a little spiel about what you were hoping Babel would do and
yes.
what it did.
Well, so what was funny was that Babel, so we launched Nerve in 1997. We launched Babel in 2007, like 10 years later. And it was, and it launched really as a more honest, not unlike, you know, Nerve aspired to be a more honest online magazine, we called it back in the late 90s, about sex and relationships and culture. And Babel aspired to be a more honest, you know, online platform about parenting. And actually, there were a lot of parallels because our view was like, because we had just, my wife and I just had a kid, and we were like, oh my gosh, there are more taboos around parenting than there are around sex. I mean, we were like, now 10 years later, like, not that it was our doing per se, but like, everybody's talking about sex, but, you know, saying like, oh man, you know, I had a kid a few years ago, but it's ruined my life, like, that, you can't say that. This is, and sort of the Hallmark card picture of, like, you know, happy baby bouncing around and thinking all the, and I, you know, and Instagram, you know, kind of exaggerates all of that, that there's the disconnect between how hard it is to be a young parent and the images that are, and stories that get shared. We thought it was just, this is back in 2007. I don't know if it's changed much, maybe it's changed a little bit, but we thought that was just a big problem. And from the perspective of people who like, you know, digital media, it was an opportunity to create a more honest, you know, platform for parents. We launched as a kind of, we were called like the hipster Brooklyn parenting site. And we gradually sort of expanded, took it more mainstream. It grew to, you know, 10, 15 million unique users a month. And we sold it to the Walt Disney Company in 2011. And it really was, we decided, because Nerve was, I'll be very honest, like, Nerve was not a commercial success. I mean, we spun out an online dating business that was quite successful. It all had a significant kind of cultural impact and scaled, but we didn't really turn it into a great outcome for investors or, you know, with Babel, we were more intentional. We said, you know what, there's an opportunity. We could do something that's interesting, and we can also do something that, you know, satisfies a need the marketplace has. And so we were able to actually build a real business, and, you know, it was a win for investors. So that was good.
You had that third ring.
Yeah, exactly. That was a third ring. I was like, yeah.
I was going to ask, because earlier you were like, 10 years later, I kind of figured it out. So maybe there it is. I guess one of my, I don't even know if this is a question, but thinking about Babel. So Jude and I have talked about this a lot in kind of brainstorming for this conversation with you. But I feel like right now in our culture, I'm specifically thinking about like TikTok and YouTube, but there's this huge, some would say, epidemic of mommy vloggers. And there's a, I feel, increasing kind of backlash that a lot of the time has to do with like a lack of consent from kids.
Oh, yeah.
And I think this specifically has to do with film, like vlogging rather than blogging, in terms of like, how do you know your kid's okay with being on camera in this vulnerable position? And I'm just interested to hear your thoughts on that.
You know, that is so interesting. And that's, you know, that really is, it's a great, question to raise, because, you know, because really those of us who were, you know, who had little kids, and were also trying to build some kind of media presence, shamelessly exploited the inability of our children to opt out of media appearances in order to further our, like, you know, online reach and ability to, you know, get a message out. And it is unfair. And I think that actually, like, we launched Babbel when the iPhone had first come out, and, you know, it was a few years later that Instagram came out. So I think in a lot of ways, that I also think that, I guess, parents to some degree are also seeking therapy, a collective therapy, by sharing their kind of challenges with their kids. But I think you're 100% right that that it's a big problem that basically there's sort of the kids don't really have the option until they reach a certain age to opt out of that kind of exposure. And so I don't know. I mean, certainly, like, as soon as a child says, no, thank you, I don't want to be, mommy, I don't want to be on your social platform, I don't want to be, they should absolutely disappear. I mean, I think every child should have the right to opt out, for sure. And I don't know, like, you know, should parents be actually prohibited from posting, you know, publicly until their child is old enough to say, yes, I want to opt in? I mean, you also see with kids that, like, there are certain ages at which they were like, oh, mommy, I want to be in the Instagram photo. Why are you always taking pictures of my brother? Right. So there's sort of, sometimes you have the reverse thing, but that's also kind of warped. It's like, oh, we have to, you know, find the photo opportunity to get more affirmation from the social community of our mothers or fathers, whatever. So I don't know. It's there's a lot of nuance there. It's an interesting question.
I, like, Lula and I have been talking about it, and I usually am on the, like, I don't really have an issue with parents talking about their children and platforming their children. But this conversation right now, I want to add a caveat. I think it's about intention. I think I cannot deal with pageants, like beauty pageants, because it's parents sexualizing and objectifying their children to basically, like, commercial, like, make money. Like, I don't know what even the intention is. Usually I think it's probably make money. That I have an issue with. YouTubers who are, like, doing ad reads and, like, making money off their children, that's weird to me. However, if you're just, like, sharing your experience, like, parents have, like, their child is part of their life. It's a big part of their life. Like, they, of course, are going to talk, like, in the same way that I talk about my parents, they're going to talk about their children. And, like, if they want to talk about, like, write a blog about, like, their child and how hard it is to have a child, like, and they're not getting anything out of it other than maybe community, I don't really have an issue with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lula does not. look at that piercing eye contact.
I'm taking in what you said. I don't know. I think agree. I think it's a good caveat to add in. I think the intention part is super important, because I think a lot of the times it's like just obvious exploitation. Like, the kid just seems unhappy a lot of the times. I think it's just, I'm thinking about it because my mind always goes to, like, the position of the kid growing up and being cognizant and then, like, discovering that their young life, like, really, really young baby early life, was broadcast. That's just where my mind goes. So I don't know. because I've also never been in that position. My parents personally were very like, I don't even want to post my kids on Facebook because they're just like scared of the internet in their own way. But I also actually had another question come up or another thought, because I was just thinking with, I don't know, hearing my own language of the mommy vlogging and just like there is, I don't think there's any equivalent for fathers. Like I'm not even, I can't think of anything. And I'm just wondering about with, I mean, Nerve, you said you were pretty focused on like kind of an even gender split with the demographic you were reaching. With, did you find the same, or not find the same? I guess it's a two-part question. Like with Babbel, was the engagement pretty split or was it very predominantly mothers?
You know, we had the aspiration to have a split demographic, you know, because I think to us that was more interesting. And obviously we want to live in a world where dads are as involved with the process and as interested.
Yeah.
But the reality was it was always like at least 85% women. And the advertisers were only interested in the moms, right? Because the view was mm-hmm. that the moms control all the financial decisions around parenting. And, you know, so we to be honest, we kind of gave up on the dads, you know, as much as I wanted them to be there. But you know, back on the prior thread, you know, I have almost no photos and zero video of my entire childhood. You know, my kids will have, you know, like more hours of video of their childhood than they will ever want to watch. And the difference between that is kind of staggering. And you know, I once, when it comes to the social posting, I once posted a photo of my son had skinned his knee like on a bicycle. And it was this kind of, I thought it was this kind of amazing photo of like, you know, a little skinned knee, was just red skinned knee and one tear coming down. And it was just like, it was so heartbreakingly adorable, but it was also like my memory of childhood. It's like what child, that's part of childhood. And I posted it with a little thing, partly because I kind of felt like, cause I was so tired of the hallmarkification of like childhood and of people's lives, right? This Instagram problem of like, oh, everybody's always happy and everybody's always photogenic and everybody and every, you know, everything's, you know, filtered and all this stuff. And I just thought, God, we need more, you know, real life in there. But then I had, of course, my wife was appropriately horrified because she was like, okay, what you're communicating is that your son was in a moment of distress and you took 5 seconds to get a photo when you could have, you know. And so she was like, what kind of father are you? And now you're telling the world that you didn't give a damn and you just want, you know. So I was like, oh God. And so I don't remember. She might have forced me to take it down or I might have taken it down. But it's you know, but I think there's a lot of interesting complexity around this question of how we filter that which we share and how we're sort of modeling for our kids or friends or communities what matters to us. I'm a big believer in posting unflattering photos of yourself online, because the problem, of course, is I joke that like everybody thinks they're unphotogenic, and maybe the reality is it's not that you're not photogenic, it's that you have an image in your head of how good looking you are that is more flattering than the reality. Right. And so we all, that's kind of an obnoxious point of view, but it's like, hey, if we actually manage down expectations for how we look, then when people see us in real life, they'll be like, oh my gosh, he or she looks so much better than I thought. I've been looking at all these photos online and wow, you look much better than that. But of course the opposite is what happens, right? Everybody's like, you know, only 1 out of 10 photos is adequately flattering. But who are you fooling? I mean, like, you know, I mean, I think there's a lot of like unhealthy psychology involved in the way people post and that it relates to both what's flattering and not flattering, but also what is sort of like, you know, the place for joy and pain and the real balance of life.
Yeah. There's not really any like actual social media platform I feel like that like balances those two things and like in a real way for like life. That was not well said, but like I'm just thinking about like Instagram, like if I went through my feed, it would just all be people partying on the beach, on boats, like just like living life to their fullest. And then like there's no like real like, oh, today was a really hard day. And like, Be Real, my least favorite social media app out there, is not real at all. Are you kidding me? Like, right? Like, it's like, oh, like I'm going to wait to take my photo until dinner time and then take a photo with all my friends at dinner. It's like, oh, cool. Like, great. So thanks for being real, you know? But there's no like emotion there either.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think a very select few, some video podcasts, I think capture some semblance of authenticity. Very few, because a lot of them now are like in a huge studio and everyone's like caked in their makeup and wearing designer clothes for some reason. But I think there are some where it's like, you know, I mean, Emma Chamberlain is the first person my mind goes to because she has this new Spotify video podcast situation. And most of her episodes are her like lying in her bed under the covers with her cats and like coffee stains. And that feels, I mean, on the one hand, that's like her brand now, which is a whole other thing. But sometimes when I do click on those, I'm like, oh, she's just, this is normal. Like, this doesn't seem too romanticized. So I don't know. I think there's an attempt there.
Yeah. Well, video keeps you honest a little bit, right?
A little more. You can't be posing for an hour straight. Yeah. Can try.
Can we actually pivot to your podcast now? Because I think that Lula and I have a lot of questions and we want to hear some advice as well.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, will you first explain how you got this podcast, where it started, when it started? And like, I know it's part of the Next Big Idea Club, but like how that all intermingles with each other.
So,
did you lose him? I think we lost you. Oh, no.
Yeah. I have a frozen moment.
Uh-oh, Rufus.
Okay. Can you hear me now? The problem is that this isn't going through my mic.
Yeah. Rufus version 2.
V2. Okay. A little tinnier, but all the color.
Yes.
A little less beige. Yeah. Okay.
Classic as we're segueing into podcast. Zoom decides to malfunction.
Perfect.
Okay, but we're back. What did you ask?
Okay, so I just want you to talk a little bit more about your podcast and how it started and how it connects to the Next Big Idea Club and anything else you'd like to talk about. I'll definitely have more questions as it arises, but if you could give a brief background of how you got into podcasting and found it.
Yeah, so we basically have had this broad view that we wanted to build a platform for connecting writers and readers in powerful new ways. And so the, you know, part of our view was that that when you think about the book as a genre or as a cultural product, you know, that a book is like 300 pages long, it takes like 10 hours to listen to. And as it turns out, most people are only listening to or reading 18 to 20% of a nonfiction book. So why does it need to be 300 pages? Why is it that length? Our view is it was, you know, that a lot of these media formats are a result of technology. So like in the same way that like a movie is, you know, 90, 120 minutes long. Well, it used to be that movie projectors were very expensive and you have to get everybody in a room. And how long can everybody sit in a room without peeing? Well, like maybe 2 hours, right? So movies are 2 hours. So what happens when you put big screens in everybody's house? Well, you get, you know, the Netflix series, and all of a sudden people realize like, hey, we can build out not just 3 compelling characters, but 12 compelling characters. And you can follow the journey of these people who you're invested in over the course of multiple seasons. And it's better for the actors. It's better for the viewers. So the format, the media format evolves with the technology would be the argument, right? And so we thought like, okay, well, books, you know, first of all, most people don't want to read the 10 to 15 hour book. And also more and more people are listening to them in audio formats. And so how will the idea delivery business evolve? And our view was it's going to move towards more and more audio and shorter formats. And so the Next Big Idea app delivers a new book every day. We say we work with Malcolm Gladwell, Adam Grant, Susan Cain, Daniel Pink, these big nonfiction writers, to pick the very best books. We say, hey, we're going to deliver a new book every day. And the author, him or herself, is going to distill that, you know, 10 hours of book down to 10 to 15 minutes of audio for you. So that's what we deliver via the Next Big Idea app. And then we thought, well, you know, we really need to tell a lot of people about this. So how will we do that? Well, let's start a podcast. And so 3 years ago, we launched the Next Big Idea podcast. And I was the host, and it's just been a blast, and it's been a real sort of learning experience for me, like an entirely new kind of challenge and experience, and also it's forced me to read a nonfiction book every week for the last 3 years. Yeah, cool. So I've been kind of force fed a lot of books.
And can you talk about what you've learned? Because I think Lula and I are wrapping up season one and have been reflecting a lot about what we've learned already. And like just hearing someone who's been so seasoned. I mean, like you've done like 193 episodes, I think maybe 194. Like that's insane.
Wow. I didn't know what the number was. So thank you for telling me. yeah, it's a bunch. And I've gotten to interview a really significant portion of my intellectual heroes, you know, which has been, you know, kind of amazing and humbling. And, I would say first on the, just speaking to the format, one of the things that I've learned in my journey as a podcast host is that I think that what people want, what I want, I think when I listen to podcasts is two things. I want the sort of like, you know, I mean, I think the sitcom, you know, Americans listen to 5 hours a day or whatever it is of television, and they have sitcoms going all the time. And it's like the experience of a party happening in your living room. Like you could be cooking in the kitchen and there are people laughing in the living room. And it's like because of the laugh track. And it's a vicarious kind of, you know, the American television sitcom is kind of a vicarious kind of funny party community experience. And I think the podcast is a vicarious sort of, you know, fun and engaging, kind of conversation with smart friends, hopefully. For me as a podcast listener, I'm connecting both to the humanity of the people, and also I'm learning about new topics, you know, and so I've sort of come to the conclusion that half of what we're trying to do is to explore, you know, ideas that can be useful to people or interesting or life expanding in some way. And the other half is just sharing the humanity of human connection, you know? But in terms of themes, you know, there's so many, as you pointed out, 190 conversations. The ones that stand out are ones with like, Yuval Noah Harari, who wrote Sapiens and everything. Like I was just giddy to get to interview him, and Steven Pinker, the great neuroscientist, and, you know, Ray Dalio, the billionaire, you know, iconoclast, and all sorts of, I've interviewed a lot of crazy people. But the ones who have changed my mind and changed the way I live my life have typically not been the most famous of them. One of them, I'll give you a few examples of like just in the last, you know, year or so, conversations that have changed the way I approach the world. One was with this Stanford addiction specialist named Anna Lemke, who wrote a book called Dopamine Nation. And she basically makes the case that we're all becoming, you know, we're all addicts. We're all addicted to our smartphones. We know that. The world's become incrementally more comfortable because we have climate control and we've got, you know, and we can obviously tap our phones for dopamine in the form of, you know, video games, for, you know, serotonin or connection in the form of, you know, social platforms, for food, for, you know, porn, for whatever it is. And she talks about how we all have a hedonic set point, which is to say, if you get what you want all the time, you build up a deficit of frustration and and discomfort. Basically, like it ends up being a recipe for depression and deep frustration to be able to get what you want all the time. And you know, when you think like 500 years ago, kings and queens, you think about the experience of like Cleopatra or, you know, like rulers from ancient times, they were hot in the summertime, bitten by insects. Their underwear was made of wool. They were cold in the wintertime. They experienced a lot of physical discomfort, right? They're, you know, there was no Novocaine when their teeth rotted out. But we know from the neuroscience of it, Dr. Anna Lemke taught me, and this is all available in the book, Dopamine Nation, that on the other side of physical discomfort is sort of joy and euphoria. So if you get in an ice bath for, you know, for 5 minutes, it hurts, but you get out of that ice bath and your body feels a radiant glow, like a euphoric radiant glow for like a half an hour. So my takeaway from that is we have to choose discomfort if we want to experience, you know, good feelings, you know, to some degree. And we have to be very careful with our susceptibility to lots of forms of addiction.
I've had this like obsession with Burning Man. And like why people would choose to go into the desert, right? And like really just like honestly try and survive in this abysmal environment. But people love it. And I think it's partly that. It's that like getting through this with community and getting through this pain really does bring you joy. It's a little confused. It's a little paradoxical, but it's
totally. Totally. Yeah. And experiencing discomfort with other people, you know, is also a bonding experience, you know, I mean, obviously, which is the silver lining to, for instance, being like a first time parent, you know, is you actually, you make really good friends in that experience. And
I have to just super quick anecdote. Last weekend, for my mom's birthday, my mom and sister and I all jumped into this freezing waterfall. And it was my first time doing like a polar plunge-esque adventure, and it was one of the craziest sensations I've ever experienced. I thought like all of my limbs were on fire and like couldn't breathe, and like got out. And it was also crazy because everyone around me there was like screaming, like jumping in and like having these huge like guttural releases. And I got out and we did like the hike back to the car or whatever, and I was like, oh, this is the happiest I've been in a year. And it was such a crazy experience. And I was like, I get the addiction of it all.
Yeah, totally. Right. Absolutely.
I also, yeah, I just had some questions pop up. I guess I have one major one, which is more of like, I think I experience this with the pod maybe more than Jude does. Okay. This is like a weird, I don't know, contradiction, I guessed, of us being podcast hosts, but I'm like very, very uncomfortable with the idea of being perceived. And I'm wondering how you feel, I guess, about having almost 200 episodes and you're kind of spilling your guts out in some ways in some of this, I imagine, and I've heard you do. And I'm just wondering how you feel about that, about like, oh, I'm kind of like not telling a version of yourself necessarily intentionally, but whatever you do tell or whatever anyone on a podcast tells is what people then use to make their judgments on you in some way or another. And I guess I'm just wondering how much you think about that, the perception of it all.
Yeah, I mean it's, you know, certainly what we put ourselves out there to some degree, right? You know, I mean, there's always the there's always the risk of saying things that, you know, that people will disagree with, or worse, conclude that you're an objectionable human being who deserves to be, you know, publicly shamed. You know, so it's, I mean, there is that, right? My own view is that it's well worth the, you know, that risk, you know, just to sort of put yourself out into the world and, you know, and meet people. I mean, I kind of think that I like this notion that the ideal life, at least from my perspective, is one in which there's almost zero daylight between your work and your play, and your personal life and your work life. And not everybody necessarily wants that. I think maybe there's some people who like their peas and mashed potatoes in separate compartments, but I think for me, that this notion that, like, we meet interesting people through our work and through our school and through, and I think expansion of community and connection with people with whom one learns things and, people who expand your world, that's like the whole business. That's what we're after. And so if you could do that in both your personal life and your work life, and the two start commingling, like, that's kind of where I personally want to be, and where I hope a lot of people get to be, because I think it's, gratifying.
I was going to ask you one of the questions, which is, and you can answer it, but I have a hypothesis. One of the questions is just that you talk with all of these incredible people on your podcast about their passions and their work and their interests. And I was wondering if you could, like, summarize what your passion or work or interest is. And, like, I want you to do it, but I just want to take a stab, because it sounds like that is what it is, what you just said, like, being with people and making connections, right? And, like, whether that's about sex or babies and connecting moms together so that they can connect, like, you're a connector. And I just think that that is so needed in this world where so many people are delving themselves into their iPhones and just spending hours scrolling. Like, having people that, like, want to connect people in spontaneous, authentic connection is just magical. So that's my guess of what you do, not to force my ideas of what your talents are onto you.
I love that. Yeah. No, I think that's very much it. And I think it's connecting and a kind of, unveiling process of, I guess if one wanted to go the nerve direction, you could say a stripping down of exposing uncertainty and vulnerability and trying to figure out, who we are and who we aspire to be. And that's part of, and that connects too with the, with the rubber ducky hats and the funny jackets and the, I think I've always been attracted to simultaneously not taking myself too seriously and encouraging other people to find lightness and comfort of movement and honesty or whatever, but doing that in the service of addressing the really serious things that we care about in life. I mean, it seems to me that, like, there are a lot of people who are very good at being serious, and there are a lot of people who are very good at being very unserious. And I think my very favorite people are people who are really good at both, and so I think that I think the commingling of those two realms has always interested me. Looking forward in the podcast in the next several months, I'm interviewing Walter Isaacson about his new book about Elon Musk, Michael Lewis about his new book about Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX implosion. But also we're going deep into AI and the existential threat of AI and the promise of AI with Stuart Russell, and a bunch of heavyweights. The truth is that I'm scared about, I'm both excited and frightened by artificial intelligence and the trend lines. And so that's, those are some of the kinds of topics that we're delving into in the next Big Idea podcast in the coming months. It's both fascinating and scary and important, and so it's all those things.
We have to wrap up here, but I will say that if you do want to keep listening to podcasts, the next Big Idea Club is the place to go, because Rufus, you're an incredible interviewer and just as good of an interviewee. So thank you so much for joining us. And this has been a true like honor. Like I feel so, so happy that you joined us and shared your wisdom. So thank you.
I second it all.
Oh, such a joy to connect with you guys. And I can't wait to listen to your podcast. And thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
Woo! Thank you for joining us. I hope everyone is having a happy Sunday when this comes out.
Yay. We'll see you next week for our season finale. Thank you so much for listening, guys.
Love you.
Bye.
Bye.